We're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Major Tom McKay is on the board. Wild Will Erskine booking the guests. In the legendary CHML newsroom, Dave Woodard and Jennifer McQueen. Here's Scott Thompson.
It is Hamilton Today. I'm Scott Thompson, 900 CHML. So here's, first of all, this is sad. We got some happy news and some sad news. So let's start with the sad news and then get that out of the way for a Friday. Bob Cole passed away, legendary NHL announcer, radio and TV. And if you don't know who Bob Cole is, listen to this.
Evan Pettisaw dropped it back. Gretzky picked it up, couldn't find it. Yzerman is turning and coming in. Another shot, score!
There you have it. And you know, we all grew up listening to that voice or voices like that that stand out in our head over the years. And Bob Cole was certainly one of the biggest and the brightest stars to ever bring us an NHL hockey game. So sad on his passing, but boy, what a full life he's led, and lots and lots of memorable moments as we remember Bob Cole. We'll talk to Bill Brio, TV critic, about that coming up a little later on. And so the good news is they've freed Willie. Willie is free. Willie, you don't know, well, the orca out in BC. They've been feeding it fish food and wondering why it's not going, and the tide's raising, and people with hooks and boats and Gilligans, and no, it's not a dolphin, it's an orca. Flipper was a dolphin. Well, you know, it's the best, but it's nice, light and cheery. Maybe the Prime Minister should use this for a theme song. There you go. See ya, Willie! Flipper, whatever the hell your name is, whatever kind of fish you are, thanks for coming. Oh, so good news. The orca out in BC is free, as we'll all be after we tear another page off the Justin Trudeau countdown calendar. 1 hour from now, you do not want to miss it. All right, what else we got going on? Another poll coming out. And, the Liberals' 3-week publicity tour for the budget just has not resonated. Another poll coming out today saying that young people, even those under 25 and under, are just not having a positive response to the budget or even our prime minister. It's fascinating. And it's interesting, too, that after the budget has failed to sort of ignite any sort of momentum in the positive direction for the Liberals, they're now attacking Pierre Poilievre. And it was interesting. I was watching a commentator on the news a few days ago saying, you know, nobody's listening. They got to start attacking Poilievre. What is he going to do? How is he going to fix it? And sure enough, like 2 days later, that's exactly what they start doing, and they're comparing them to Trump and, you know, all these wacky people in the United States and all this other sort of stuff. And, you know, I don't think it's going to be a case of what does Pierre Poilievre have that he doesn't have. It's like, no, nobody wants him anymore. They want change. And again, in my 60 years on the planet, I don't ever remember hop, skipping, and jumping to the polls going, I'm going to vote for this person. I can't wait to vote for this person. This person is the best in the world. I can't wait to go vote for this person. And I don't know anybody that has. You usually go in to get the other person out. And that's exactly what this is. So again, you want to know what Pierre Poilievre is going to do on housing? Well, look at the plan that Justin Trudeau just announced. That's pretty much what he's going to do. That's information that's been given from housing experts, developers, and the opposition parties and even himself back in 2015. So, you know, I really don't think it's about, okay, well, look at this guy. Let's see if this guy's any better. Well, no, they're all politicians. But in Canada, we vote left, then we vote right, then we vote left, then we vote right. And hopefully the country lands somewhere in the center, which is where the majority of Canadians are, not on the extremes where Justin Trudeau and the NDP have taken us to the left. And, you know, as Bill Maher so eloquently put, As soon as you take the center left and push it to the extreme left, you drive the center to the right. Same thing if you take everybody to the extreme right, you're going to push the center to the left. And that's exactly what is going on now. And it's fascinating because if we're to learn anything from provincial politics from Ontario, which they always say, you know, is mimicked at the federal level, both the conservative and the liberal leaders of the provincial parties are bringing both those parties back to the center. And yet Justin Trudeau, for some reason, is just, you know, climbing into bed with Jagmeet Singh, who now maybe even has the momentum to become the official opposition. So it's been fascinating to watch all of this, including Captain Climate Change, all of a sudden change his focus to what the majority of Canadians are talking about, but many are just tuned out, including the younger people, and whatever.
Evan Trebizond dropped it back. Gretzky picked it up, couldn't find it. Yzerman is turning and coming in. Another shot, score! Yzerman scores! Detroit wins the game! Detroit wins the series! And they go on!
All right, there you have it. The legendary Bob Cole passing away just the other day. NHL broadcaster. We all remember that voice from TV, radio, what have you, over the decades. And it just added so much excitement to the game. Let's bring in Bill Brio, TV critic and author, with us now. Bill, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I'm doing fine there, Scott. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. When you listen to or watch a U.S. broadcast of hockey, it is a different feel, almost a different lingo to it, a different vibe, as when you watch it on Canada. And Bob Cole certainly was legendary for that sound and just his approach.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, he had such a passion for the game, and it came through in his voice and in his phrases. And it brought you into the game. And that was a big part of why we listened to him on Hockey Night in Canada.
What makes a great broadcaster like this, whether it's on starting on radio, going over to TV, what makes a great play-by-play guy?
You know, part of it is personality. I think that you can be really have a great memory. You could have all the names down cold. But Foster Hewitt never really did. You know, if you remember him, Cornwallier.
Yeah.
He tried to say Yvonne Cornwallier. He never did get it right. And we listened to him during the Canada-Russia series. And that was an adventure. But it didn't matter because when he said he shoots, he scores, you just leapt out of your seat. And that's, you know, that's the key, whether it's baseball, football, hockey, is I think the announcer has to bring you to the game.
And for a long time, that was sort of the sound of Canadian hockey, wasn't it? I mean, even those that followed in his footsteps or did it in other areas or such, they copied that. They used that as a guide.
Well, Bob Cole sure did. You know, he the story goes that he was playing soccer. He was quite involved in sports in Newfoundland, and he broke his ankle or hurt his leg, and he was held up for 6 months in the hospital, and he started listening to Foster Hewitt on the radio, and he thought, man, there's a job, you know, and he worked at it, and he came to Toronto, went to CKFH, Foster Hewitt, the old radio station, and brought a demo tape and asked if this be given to Foster Hewitt, and the secretary said, well, hold on, he's here. Foster brought him into the office, listened to the tape, and then spent 2 hours putting on a clinic, basically telling him, well, this is good, but don't do that and do this. Mm. And it really, that's why he sounded a lot like Foster Hewitt. He was, he got a masterclass.
As I was mentioning earlier, it's funny how watching a Canadian broadcast sounds different of hockey than watching the Americans do it.
Yeah, it sure does. And I'm not sure 100% why that is. I think that if you listen to Al Michaels do football, you know, any of the great ones, Harwell at Detroit used to do a lot of great Detroit games. People all have their favorites, even the Blue Jays announcers, you know. But there's an enthusiasm for the game that comes through and changes. So I don't know. Are Americans more homers than Canadian announcers? I don't know. I think it's also
because there's just an influence of so many other sports. Whereas in Canada, you know, especially during that era, hockey was it. Hockey is king. Whereas in the United States, if someone's doing hockey, they're probably doing baseball, football, basketball, what have you as well.
Yeah, I think so. You know, and Bob Cole did curling. He did some other sports as well, but there's something about the phrases, right? You know, he scores with Foster Hewitt, and of course, Bob Cole would say, "Oh, baby," and we all remember that.
Yeah.
And touch them all. The Blue Jays phrase. These are the ones that stay in your head. Kurt Gowdy, of course, had a lot of them. So the great ones had just the right thing to say at the right moment. You know, Al Michaels covering hockey. He was the one that coined the phrase at that moment when the American team won in 1980. So you have to be present and really ready to not just, he scored. You know, you have to say something.
I don't know if I could imagine Bob Cole doing curling. Is there an oh baby in curling? I don't know. Maybe when you're at the bar.
Yeah, I can't disagree with you, Scott, but certainly hockey did it. And from what I understand, you know, Ron McLean was on the other night on talking about stories about Bob Cole. All the great players, Sidney Crosby would call Cole before the start of every season. Wayne Gretzky loved Bob Cole calling games. So great hockey players really loved great announcers, and they found that Bob Cole added to the excitement of what you were watching.
Bill Brail with us, TV critic and author, commenting on the life and times of Bob Cole, a legendary NHL broadcaster. Bill, thanks for the time and insight. Always appreciate it. Have a great weekend.
You too, Scott.
All right, a wrap-up of what Trump's been doing for the last week in the courts of the United States of America. Brian J. Cram with us, journalist, author, White House correspondent for Playboy, political analyst for CNN. Here now, Brian, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Doing well. Not in court. Mark me safe from being in court today.
So are you in the courtroom? Do you watch this going on?
It's they don't have a camera in the courtroom. So those of us who can't get in are relying on those of us who can. It's a lottery system to get in there. And there are thousands of people who would love to sit in there. I don't know why. I spent 4 years next to the guy. As far as I can stay away from him, I'm happy to do so. But that's that.
Let me ask you this, and because everything is about him and his trials and the trials and tribulations and such. Has Donald Trump addressed any of the issues that are pressing Americans on a day-to-day basis or even the world issues, whether it's Ukraine, Russia, China, what have you? Has he given any position politically on the politics of this, or has it all strictly been about him and his trials?
Scott, is that a trick question?
Because I just realized that, you know, I'm listening, I'm watching Biden speak about stuff. I was like, we never hear Trump speak about this stuff.
No. Like, all the emails and all the speeches about Donald Trump have been, they're out to get me. They can't take away my stage from me. They can't take away Trump Tower. They're going to throw me in jail. Me. He sounds like a little kid on a playground. And yeah, meanwhile, you got the president of the United States trying to deal with two wars, the economy, inflation, global warming, climate change, education, health care. And Donald Trump's upset because he's in court because he did it to himself. Nice observation you make, but it really is. Donald Trump's never said anything in his life that didn't have to do with Donald Trump.
It does that resonate with Americans that as they're going through the day-to-day life, and as you said, the president's being the president and addressing the issues that he has to address, that Donald Trump isn't addressing that or what he's going to do for America, other than maybe a wall or so. But is that resonating with Americans that, you know, he really hasn't said about what he's going to do for me?
More and more, yes. I think that the more Donald Trump, I still think that at the end of the day, he may not even be on the ticket come this fall. I think Donald Trump is, if you've listened to him, you've watched him as I have. I think he's, you know, they talk about Joe Biden being fragile. Donald Trump, I think, is suffering from dementia. And I think it's becoming increasingly apparent every day. And speaking with neurologists, they say, listen, you know, it's classic. And at the end of the day, he'll eventually fall off the cliff, as they call it. And then, you know, he'll just be sitting there in a puddle of his own sweat and makeup, babbling like a cicada. That's about all he's got left on his plate. There's no gas in his tank. And even those who have supported him, you know, I've talked to some of the MAGA supporters going there for the first time. They're looking at the possibility that Donald Trump won't be on the ballot. And so when they go to Milwaukee for their national convention, they're talking about what a circus that's going to be, because they don't know how the heck they're going to pick a candidate. So it's I think at the end of the day, even those who have supported Trump in the past are concerned about him moving forward. But we'll see. I mean, you know, this is only April, the end of April. We still haven't had the conventions for either party. So anything could happen. And every day that he's in court shows us just how incapable and incompetent and demented he is. As I said, a neurologist said, if he is reelected, it'll be like the movie Weekend at Bernie's, his second administration.
So, and we talked about this in the past. I think last time we spoke that he started talking about something and then just started freestyling and off he went in a million different directions. We're now hearing that there may be a debate or that Biden will debate him or whatever. What can we expect in a debate if he can't stick to the scripts per se?
Do you remember the Muppet Show when the two guys sat up in the balcony? You kids, get off my lawn. That's what you're going to see in a debate. And it's going to be Donald Trump babbling like a drunken cicada. I don't think that. I heard that today on Biden made a surprise trip over to the Howard Stern show and said that he would debate him. They just haven't figured out when or how. Well, I don't know that that's going to come off. I'd be surprised if there were a debate, because honestly, if you're controlling and handling Donald Trump, the last thing you want is him on a stage debating Joe Biden. Joe Biden may be tired and showing signs of the age of an 81-year-old man, but he still is far more with it than Donald Trump. And I don't want to see two, you know, octogenarians on stage debating. I can't imagine what that would look like.
Doesn't there have to be a debate of some sort, though? I mean, isn't that just part of the whole thing?
No, there's nothing in there. There's nothing in the laws of the United States that say they must debate. It's kind of a tradition. It's happened a lot. I mean, you know, we can go back to the Lincoln Douglas debates, the Kennedy Nixon debates, the Reagan debates. There have been debates, but there's no law that says they must exist.
Wouldn't Americans want to see that? I know I would.
Well,
I might jump on pay-per-view for that one, Brian.
That's right. It'd be better than WWE, I'll tell you that.
sure.
It would, just for the comic effect, I'd like to see it, but
you don't think we're gonna see that then?
I still want to see who's going to be the candidates. It depends on who the candidates are as to whether or not we'll see the debate between, you know, these two guys. There might be, but there might be only one. It might be heavily policed by, there's a lot of ways you could set it up so it isn't a true debate. So like I said, I'm a little skeptical, because I know that if you're handling Donald Trump right now, you may think it'd be fun to get him out there. But the reality is that's going to just tear Trump. And you could see it in court. When he comes out after court, he can't handle the pressure anymore. He's got three more of these court dates to go through. I don't think it's going to be real good for Donald Trump to be in front of the public for an extended amount of time and showing his dementia. But I could be wrong. I've been wrong before. I thought I was wrong once and I was mistaken.
Okay, so give us a quick update of this past week. Obviously, the National Enquirer involved in the testimony this week. So what can we take from this week?
Anybody by the name of David Pecker that's running
I was going to let you say it, Brian, since I brought up the flatulence last time. I was going to let you say Pecker this time.
Yeah, you set it up there for me. That was
there you go.
Nice setup. I think what David Pecker has shown is what colorectal cancer journalism looks like, and that's him. And it's what is most enlightening about the testimony this week is not just how bad that so-called journalism is, but the people that Donald Trump surrounded himself with, you know, they're just the worst of the worst. And if you're going to, in essence, prostitute your values for Donald Trump, what are your values? This guy was running PR flack for Donald Trump. And of course, it is the National Enquirer, which, you know, I ate Bigfoot's baby and, you know, I had a threesome with space aliens type of stuff. So, I mean, that only tells you just how decrepit and degenerate Donald Trump is.
Brian J. Karam.
That's the biggest takeaway.
Brian J. Karam, journalist and author, White House correspondent for Playboy and analyst for CNN. Always fun, Brian. Thanks for the time. Have a great weekend.
You too, brother. Stay dry, stay fun. Have a good one.
This weekend marks the 31st annual Paris to Ancaster bike race. A record field of riders registering this race climbs the Martin Road Hill, finishing at the Ancaster Rotary Center on Jerseyville Road. Last year event drew nearly 2,500 riders, wet, mud. You've seen the pictures run as one of four routes ranging from 20 to 110 K. Let's bring in John Thorpe, co-founder of the race, race director for the Paris to Ancaster bike race. And here now, John, thank you for the time. Hope you're doing well.
Hey, Scott. Great to hear from you. Thanks for calling.
So, man, how many years have we been talking about this? Let's go back to the very beginning. How did this all get started?
Well, it was a way to... We were doing a bunch of events back at the time. I don't know if you remember, we used to run a race around Hess Village, a little bike race. And to extend our season, we decided to do a spring race that was mimicking some of the races that happen in Europe. So we did it not far from the start of April. And it was, it turned out to be this beautiful day, and like 300 people came out. So it was amazing. And
so
it just, basically growing from there.
So talk about what gives this race character. Talk about the route. What makes it what it is?
It's the route. That's what it is. Okay. And I've just come back. We've been putting up directional arrows and clearing up places. And there's these, there's just some spectacular countryside between Brant County coming into Ancaster. We use some of the developed rail trails, the ones that listeners would have been on themselves, but we also use private properties where there were old rail lines that the farmers now own. And so they're still there. They've got, you know, the great build-up gravel bed of railway lines. So although they get a little overgrown, we're able to use them in the spring even when the weather is rough.
And this isn't for the faint of heart. This is true mountain biking. Is that accurate?
I would say not true mountain biking in the sense that out in Whistler, they do true mountain biking.
Okay.
Remember, yeah. We're from Hamilton, the mountain.
That's right. Okay.
Right. But what it is, it's a cross between mountain biking and road bike. They now call it gravel racing. And gravel racing is the latest thing in North America. And so we sort of joked that we were gravel before gravel existed.
You were gravel before gravel was cool.
Yeah, you got it.
So who comes to this? Who participates?
We've got probably a field of about 500 very serious racers. I shouldn't quite say that, like 500 variety of ages. The top racers are competitors. I just mentioned, I'm up in Ancaster now, and I ran into Quentin DeSera, who last time I saw him was the Pan Am Games at Hardwood Hills. So he's a guy who's racing, you know, international level events, be a favorite for this event. But then you have all sorts of other people, and the other sort of 2,000 people are a combination of weekend warriors, people who just like a challenge, some people who just want to ride their bike. Big range of abilities. One of the cool things about it is all these people who do the same course on the same day as the pros do it.
So talk about how challenging this course is and the various routes.
Okay, so the challenge is the weather. There are no real sections that are, you know, scary, challenging. Now, Martin's Road, as you know, that the hill at the end is a brilliant.
Yeah.
The weather is probably the big challenge. Last year,
right,
it poured the whole thing, and people came in, and you couldn't, you know, we were having to hose them off to find out who won the race.
So why do people come to this? What makes this race, this road race, unique? And how has it lasted for 31 years?
You know, I was going to say I have no clue, but I'll tell you what, I think I do now. First of all, it's the first race of the year, so people look forward to the cycling season opening. And from our point of view, we're out there in the countryside, and the leaves are coming out, and the, blossoms are blooming, and it's like, wow, everybody's happy at this time of year, right? So I think that's a big part of it. But the other part of it is, compared to any other race or ride, there's lots of great rides out there throughout the year. But this one, everybody who rides it has their own unique story. So they have something that happened to them that was different from everybody else, or you know, whatever it may have been. And last year there was the mud farm that was a new section of course that, due to the rain, just turned into about a 2 kilometer mud slog. but there's just always something to talk about, basically.
And how many participants this year? And is there room for spectators, or is it, or do they get in the way?
We'd love to have spectators out. We have about 2,700 competitors. Parking is always an issue, but there is parking within the area. And we would love to see spectators come out and watch the event. I think a lot of people who participate in the event, you know, they get it and they go and tell people about it. But unless you've seen these people come across the finish line last year, just black in mud, and the only thing you can see is this big white smile on their face.
You really
have trouble getting it.
John Thorpe with us, Paris to Ancaster Bike Race, 31st annual Paris to Ancaster Bike Race happening this weekend. Whether you're participating or watching, get out and enjoy whatever the weather delivers. John, good luck with it this year.
Thanks, Scott. Good to talk to you again.
If Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer,
he'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk,
900 CHML.
Remember there was a time when we had too many teachers? And then they changed, the way in which teachers qualify to become teachers and such. And there was that cohort that kind of got stuck in the middle of all of that. So why do we have a shortage now, or situations where there just isn't enough? Randall Denley is with us, author and columnist with the Ottawa Citizen and the National Post. His latest: union sees it that Ontario students don't have enough teachers. Why should the union do something to benefit its own retirees and help the province's students when it can attack the government? To talk more about all of this, Randall Denley with us now. Randall, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I am, Scott. Thanks.
So, Randall, explain this in the sense that, considering where we have been in the last several decades, it seemed this round of negotiations went on behind closed doors. There was ratification. What's the term I'm looking for?
They agreed to go to arbitration.
Arbitration and such. And all that sort of stuff. And it looked like we were sort of in a new era with the teachers' unions and governments, that we weren't going to have the annual or every couple of years, 3 years, threats of a strike. So is there a good relationship there between government and the unions, or is it always as bad as it's ever been?
No, I don't think it'll ever get better. They just see themselves as, well, let's put it this way. The unions see the government as their natural enemy. It doesn't really matter what government it is.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how much they're paid or anything else. It's never enough. Their wages are pressed. Their working conditions are horrible. And, you know, the teaching unions see an opportunity to emphasize that point, even by doing something that's, to me, largely unrelated. You know, the province has gotten itself into a bad supply problem with teachers, and there's really no excuse for it, because it's fairly predictable how many teachers will leave every year, either through attrition or retirement. So you would think, okay, so our teachers' colleges should be able to graduate enough new teachers to fill those spots. That would seem like kind of, you know, basic human resource planning.
Hmm.
But somehow they just haven't done it. And as you were saying, years ago, they were producing way more teachers than we needed. That finally stopped in 2015 under Kathleen Wynne. She said, hey, let's make it a 2-year program. Not because it needed to be, really, but because that was a way of slowing down the supply of teachers. It was okay for a few years till they used up the surplus of teachers. But we've been short teachers now, and struggling for the last 2 or 3 years. And you would thought somebody would have done something about it by now, but they haven't. So the unions see an opportunity here to beat their favorite drum, basically.
Mm.
During the pandemic, they graciously allowed retired teachers to teach for 95 days a year, just to help out.
Right.
Okay, good. But now, of course, that's over. But the government says, but we still need them, because we're short of people. You know, so much so that in many classrooms across the province in any given day, they don't have a real teacher in front of the classroom. And you think if you cared about kids, you say, well, that's no good. and these retirees want to work, so let's just let them work. What's the problem? Nope. It used to be a 50-day limit. That's what we're going back to. It's in the contract. And if you ask them why, they, well, we got to force the government to solve this problem with teacher shortage. Okay, but how is that going to force the government to do it? All it does is hurt kids. It hurts retired teachers who want to keep teaching. And it benefits no one, really, but it's just the union taking an opportunity to flex its muscles and say, you know, if our working conditions weren't so horrible, people wouldn't be leaving the profession by the tens of thousands. And there'd be lots of teachers. Okay, that's like highly theoretical at best, I would say. But what about the problem we have right now every day in schools? Can't you help out? No, not going to help. It's your problem, government. I just thought, you know, given all the things you were just referring to about the somewhat more mature approach to negotiations over the last year or so, that maybe we had turned a corner in Ontario where unions were going to act more responsibly, but I guess not.
And, you know, and I remember very vividly having Harvey Bischoff, I believe it was, who is the head of the secondary school union, when, you know, they get in this fight with every government, the argument we had like 5-10 years ago. And he said, well, they're all the governments are out to raid the education system. And I stopped him right there. I was like, holy smokes, that's a little much. I mean, they all might have different ways on how to do it, but I think they're trying to do what's right. And then him and Hammond were sort of gone. And I thought we were sort of ushering in a new era of negotiation, a new era of civility, and we'd sort of gotten past this.
Yeah, it's such a non-factual argument. And teachers in Ontario at full 10-year seniority make more than teachers in any other province in the country.
Yeah.
Enrollment in Ontario has been pretty much flat for more than a decade, yet the number of teachers has gone up every year. The province has never spent more on education than it spends now. So it's pretty hard to say, oh, we're being underfunded and, you know, we're being treated badly. Yet there are a lot of issues in schools. There's no doubt about it. A lot of it is discipline. And I think the root of a lot of that is the fact that, well, we're afraid to discipline anybody because, you know, someone might be offended, or what about their background, their story? We just don't want to discipline anybody. So it makes it very difficult for teachers to manage classes, and that's stressful. And I'm sure that does lead to some attrition in the teaching profession. But unless they intend to change that, and I don't think they do, we have to deal with the reality we have, which to me is pretty clear. You increase the number of places in teachers' college. They seem to get that, the government does, when it comes to trades. Let's get more and more people into trades training. We're short of people.
Right.
It makes perfect sense. But somehow when it comes to teachers, something completely under their control, no, we won't do that.
How long do you expect the shortage to last?
Until they make a move to increase the number of teachers. And even if they made that move tomorrow, we'd be looking at a couple more years. But the Ontario College of Teachers, which is their regulatory body, figures are about 1,400 teachers short in terms of the graduate class every year. Now it's going to get a little bit worse by the end of the decade. So that's the number we need. There's about 4,600 who graduate most years. We need to add 1,400 to that. It doesn't sound like an impossible thing to do, but it just doesn't seem to be on their radar. And it's such an obvious solution. You know, the minister, Stephen Lecce, who I think does a good job most of the time, would say, well, look, you know, these teachers, they're taking 16 days of sick leave on average. So there you are. I mean, that's a small part of the picture.
Yeah.
But it's the government's job to have an adequate number of teachers available. And that means actually more teachers than you need to fill the existing jobs, because you need teachers for when people are off sick or take some kind of a leave. You need people available to fill in. And for years, we had way, way too many of them. But now we got way too few.
It's amazing you can go from one extreme to the other and can't land somewhere in the middle. Randall Denley is with us, author, columnist for the Ottawa Citizen and the National Post. His latest, Union See to It That Ontario Students Don't Have Enough Teachers. Randall, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
Yeah, my pleasure, Scott. Thanks a lot.
900 CHML. It's Hamilton Today. We're coming right back.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
We've talked about this at length. because the prime minister talked at length about the budget about 3 weeks every single day, banging one item after another, and another $1 billion or so because you don't understand it. They weren't getting their point across. Obviously, over 3 weeks, they have, and nothing has changed. So it's not the messenger, it's the message, or maybe it is the messenger. Obviously, people are getting it loud and clear, the message. They just don't like it. And Ipsos polling, 4 in 5 Canadians now feel that owning a home is only for the rich. Think about that. I have a hard time even saying that, let alone imagining it, that 4 out of 5 Canadians now feel owning a home is only for the rich. What has happened to the middle class? What has happened to the middle class that the prime minister speaks of so frequently every time he's in front of a microphone? The middle class and those that are trying to join it. And now the middle class can't even afford a home. And many think that that's an impossibility unless, of course, you're rich. Let's bring in Daryl Bricker, CEO of Ipsos, with us now. Daryl, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Doing well, Scott. Thanks.
It's amazing. I don't know. Is it me, Daryl? I'm a guy of 60. Is it me that's just 4 out of 5 Canadians now feel that owning a home is only for the rich? That sounds amazing to me. What are your thoughts? Yeah.
Well, it really is the death of the middle class dream. I mean, we really do think that owning your own home is a fundamental aspect of being part of the middle class. But the thing that's really surprising to me, even beyond the 80% number, is that number's gone up 11% in the last year.
It's odd, though, because the prime minister speaks so highly, so heavily, so frequently about the middle class and those trying to join it. Is that messaging changing now? I mean, it's less about the middle class and more of attacking the rich. But it just seems to be a very odd contrast.
Yeah, well, it's pretty clear, pardon me, based on the messaging around the budget, that they're doing very similar types of polls and coming up with very similar answers. And they're now laser focused on trying to address this question. And a lot of what the budget was putting out, and particularly when you take a look at who is most upset about this and most focused on the need to still own a home is younger Canadians, was really focused on addressing this question. But as we saw earlier in the week when we put out polling on the budget, people weren't convinced.
We certainly know for the last 8 years, it's been all climate change all the time. And again, we know the majority of Canadians are very concerned about climate change. Where they different opinion is how to best address that. Now we've gone from all climate change all the time to now affordability all the time. And obviously that's not resonating. Are we going to see, do you think we'll see, or would it make a difference if he attacked the things that were really concerning for Canadians, i.e. the carbon tax, which tax after tax after tax just doesn't seem to be resonating with people?
Yeah, and along with the capital gains, increasing capital gains. Whenever people hear carbon tax or capital gains tax, it's the first part of the phrase in small letters and the tax part in large letters.
Yeah.
All they see now is a tax and a government that seems to have a real desire to increase taxes, fairly or unfairly. That's how it's being interpreted. And so when they look at things, for example, like government spending, they think it's out of control in many instances, although it may be allocated to programs that they think are important. Mm-hmm. But a lot of this has less to do with what the government's actually saying and who is actually saying it. This is what you were alluding to earlier in the conversation, because there are elements of what the government did in its budget when you actually talk to people about them, independent of who it is that's saying that they'll be doing it, that have some appeal with Canadians. But when you say it's this government and they're focused on it, that's where both the credibility of the government gets undermined, and also the credibility of what it is that they're saying they want to implement.
Plus, a lot of the stuff that they're talking about in the housing, the recent housing budget, has already been mentioned by opposition parties or even housing experts that should have been done long ago, including their own promises back in 2015. Since this hasn't made an impact and hasn't seemed to move the meter at all, the opinion polls. Many have said it's still early, and obviously they're out there just hammering it every day, still trying to sell this. Do you see it changing after a week or two or a month? Is this going to all of a sudden, there's a bright light here?
No, if it was going to change, it would have changed right away. I mean, they spent 2 weeks, as you said before, even longer, hammering away on these messages. And then everybody's focused on budget day. I shouldn't say everybody, the percentage of Canadians who are interested in it, which is maybe, you know, 2/3 of us, look at budget day. And the only thing that comes out on budget day is the increase in capital gains taxes. And whether you like or don't like the message of the government, as I said before, I should say message of the government related to their motivation, which is to make sure that everybody pays their fair share. What Canadians heard was increase in taxes.
Yeah.
So it's like the whole thing got muddied up. And you don't even have to you don't have to speculate. You don't have to wonder. I mean, there's been four polls that have come out since the budget five polls that have come out since the budget has come forward. Only one of them has shown any sort of improvement. The other four, we're all showing exactly the same thing, where the government's running 20 points behind.
Do you see a reversal in their fortunes if they say change or alter the capital gains tax issues or even the carbon tax? Is it too late?
It probably is too late, and I think the Prime Minister has shown that he has a lot of conviction about both of these policies. And when you get that high up in terms of how far you're prepared to go in order to implement these kinds of things, to reverse it at this stage of the game is probably not going to be greeted too well. And the evidence of that is the change that they made in gas tax relative to the home heating oil issue in Atlantic Canada. And when that happened, he was vilified by both sides, one side for not doing enough and another side for doing anything at all. So my suspicion, my expectation is that he will continue to plow through on these for as long as he can and for as long as he stays.
Where does this leave the NDP, Daryl, as more and more people are talking perhaps an earlier election? At what point do they fish or cut bait?
Well, they should be cutting bait right now, actually fishing right now. They've really got two options that anybody who is really interested in expanding the electoral prospects for the NDP would be seriously considering. One of them is going back to the government and saying, look, I want a new deal and I want more control over what's going to be happening over the space of the next year and a half. So whether that's cabinet seats or whether that's very firm commitments of certain things that need to get done, since the NDP is being tarred with the same brush as the government anyway, they might as well take more control over what's going on. So if somebody's going to play it tough, they're going to play it tough on that deal. And the government has never been as weak as they are at this moment. So even the threat of the government saying, well, we won't give you that and we'll trigger an election. The NDP doesn't have an election. It doesn't trigger election. They're risking a circumstance in which the Liberals could change leaders, or maybe some of the stuff does catch on. And if we get to next October and we have an election, there's a very real possibility that the bottom could drop out for the NDP and they'll end up in fourth place. So their time is now.
The question is
whether or not they've got the political fortitude to pursue that.
Do you think that's why they've taken so long to announce whether they're going to support this or not? That's hardly even been a news story.
It's going to get interesting as we go on here, because the truth is that this budget at the moment is dead on arrival. And as I said, if you pull the rug out from them to the government right now, they've got two problems. The only thing that people really know about what they're going to do is implement this budget, which nobody likes, or very few people like. And the second thing is they're going to be campaigning with Justin Trudeau as the leader. And we already know how the Canadians feel about him.
Daryl Bricker, CEO of Ipsos Polling, 4 in 5 Canadians now feel owning a home is only for the rich, according to Ipsos. Daryl, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Have a great weekend.
You too, Scott. Thank you.
The New York Court of Appeals, in a scathing 4-3 judgment, overturned Harvey Weinstein's conviction on sex crimes against three women, finding the trial judge erroneously admitted testimony of uncharged alleged prior sexual acts against persons other than the complainants of the underlying crimes. The court said that testimony served no material non-propensity purpose and portrayed the defendant in a highly prejudicial light. To talk more about all of this, Ari Goldkind, Toronto criminal lawyer, with us now. Ari, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Always good to be on with you.
Your thoughts, Ari, and was this the right decision here?
So I got to premise this answer by saying your listeners know I'm not a bleeding heart. I am a very passionate defense lawyer, but I call a spade, okay? Mm-hmm. So the reason I preface that is for everybody thinking, oh, Harvey Weinstein's a pig. Oh, he's an ogre. Oh, he must have done something. Oh, he's ugly. I don't care that you think that. His trial was a joke. He should never have been convicted. The three Court of Appeal judges that didn't overturn his conviction should all be ashamed of themselves. They actually don't know the law. The trial was a sham. And for all of your listeners going, what's that defense lawyer talking about? It's the Me Too movement, and he's defending a pig. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's stop right there. If Harvey Weinstein was a popular person, a good-looking person, a Teflon Don person like Justin Trudeau, and he had a trial where three people were accusing him of something that was immensely defendable, that didn't really make a lot of sense. But rather than just relying on those three people's evidence to say, this is what we did in hotel rooms that we went to, they called in five or six other people who hate him, called in five other six people that he's not charged with any crime with, but all to talk about what a pig and ogre he is. Most sensible people would say a trial shouldn't be won or lost on whether somebody is popular or unpopular, gross or handsome. And the four, by the way, a majority female-led court in New York, by the way, for the Court of Appeal, four judges came out and said, look, we're not saying he's innocent. We're not saying he's guilty. But when you bring in all these uncharged women and uncharged people to say he does all of this and all that, then you're going to cross-examine him on things he's not even charged with doing. That's a kangaroo court-like trial. And by the way, to your listeners who, again, disagree with me because it's very easy and popular to be a Me Too virtue signaler, we wouldn't allow such a thing to happen in Canada. So if you think it's just a U.S. thing, we don't allow what's called bad character or propensity evidence to throw an unpopular ogre under the bus. We have fair trials, and he should be convicted or acquitted based on what his accusers have to say and nobody else. And good for the New York court. Again, I still think the three that upheld it should be ashamed of themselves. And I wouldn't be surprised if something similar happens in Los Angeles.
So is this based on bad procedure and just bad turn of events overseen by the judge, or is it evidence-based?
The judge was ridiculous. The judge was as ridiculous as the Trump judge. I'm not a fan of Trump, so don't think this is a Trumpy statement, but he's getting a kangaroo-like court judge there as well. I mean, all you have to do is look into the judge and his family, and you know that the way we do things here with judges, which is very apolitical, we tend to want to not know how they vote, who they give money to, who they're partisans for. It's different in New York. That judge rigged the case against Harvey Weinstein. And by the way, it was rigged so badly that we should take something from the fact that Harvey Weinstein was acquitted for over 50% of what he was charged with in that case. Now, this is in New York, where he's still looked at as a pig, and he was acquitted of some very serious charges. That's how weak the case against him was from his actual indicted accusers. You then bring in the 5, 6, 7, 10 other people that are suing him. They want a big paycheck. Don't get mad at me. I don't get politically correct on your air. They're all, most of them are suing him. They're represented by Gloria Allred. You can get into the politics here. We don't have the time of it. But when you do that in a criminal court, the court of public opinion, fine. Twitter, fine. Facebook, fine. 900CHML, fine. But when somebody's liberty is at stake, it is one of the most sacrosanct rules for fair trials that we don't rig the trial just based on somebody that we don't like. That's not blind justice. He didn't receive justice. And I'm even surprised, as I said, that New York, as politicized as it is, overturned it, but good for the four judges who had the brain power, the three others didn't.
Ari Goldkind with us, Toronto criminal lawyer, New York Court of Appeals, 4-3 opinion overturning Harvey Weinstein's conviction on sex crimes against three women. Ari, thanks for the time. We'll chat again. Be well.
Good to be with you.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk
900 CHML.
Listen to this. Real output per capita has fallen to 7% below its long-term trend since the pandemic, resulting in a decline of roughly $4,200 per person, according to a new report from Stats Canada. To quote Bill Maher, I don't know what that means, but it sounds serious. Let's bring in Eric Hamm, professor of economics, Toronto Metropolitan University, and here now. Eric, thanks for the time. I hope you are doing well.
I am, and you're right, it is serious. But first, happy Passover, Scott.
And back at you. Thank you for taking the time. What does this mean? Real output per capita has fallen 7% below its long-term trend since the pandemic. What does this mean to the average Joe?
Well, you know, we can do this quite simply. Most of the time that I'm honored to come on the radio with you, we talk about the demand side of the economy. We get mired in interest rates, exchange rates, anything that we loosely consider aggregate demand, consumption, investment, the spending side of the economy. And so we've been kind of since COVID looking at the spending side saying, is this where all the trouble comes in? Because that's the relatively easier one to fix. And so we've talked a lot about that. So now what we're doing is we're looking at the other side of the outhouse, literally the supply side. We're saying what happens when things like productivity, which is another way of saying output per worker, starts to decline. So it's just a fancy way of saying what happens when the supply side of the economy starts to go into a tailspin. And it's no less important than the demand side. So why is this even an issue? It goes back again to where are we in the economy? Our productivity matched with our GDP growth has been, in a word, abysmal. So just to give you a comparison, this output per worker, or again, productivity, has been rising in the US at a rate of about 1.5 to 2%. And in Canada since 2019, we're at about 0.3%. Now, long-winded, but why do we care? Well, we just went through a budget that brought in a ton of higher taxes. And that is not going to be at all beneficial to this number. And it's not going to improve the trajectory of our economic growth. So it means, once again, we have basically the government and the Bank of Canada getting in each other's way and tripping over each other's feet. So there's my long-winded answer. It means that we've kind of exhausted the demand side issues. Now we're on to the supply side. And I've used the quote before, but we can't win at home. We can't win on the road. And Scott, we're running out of places to play.
So obviously the prime minister less concerned in the past about economics, more about social issues, saving the planet, that sort of thing. But now the rubber is hitting the road. Is this conversation different because productivity is dramatically fallen? Innovation, investment. If times are good, we're not having these discussions.
No, of course not. And as I said, we don't want to have these discussions because the government can, to some extent, always use its credit card, which has no spending limit and no deadline, to prime the economy when necessary. And you saw that last week to an extent, the government saying, let's just throw money at it the way that liberal governments tend to do, right? We know that Freeland indicated the government would help create conditions for interest rates to fall. Question is, was that achieved? And the answer really is no. The tax increases may dampen inflationary spending, but they're going to raise the deficit so high over the next 5 years that these things may just accommodate each other. So again, Bank of Canada, Government of Canada tripping over themselves. And then finally, to that point, the fiscal plan of this economy, the one they brought out in their budget, well, that looks really good if the economy is steadily or even slowly expanding. But guess what? Ours isn't. So while the government may stand and congratulate themselves over the potential for new policies to boost economic growth, Again, I think the new taxes are going to accommodate that out. So the demand side is in trouble. The supply side is in trouble. But it is easier at the end of the day, Scott, to stimulate the demand side. So we're just going to have to deal with the supply side for a while.
The prime minister is selling this like he's taxing the rich. In the past, he has continually mentioned the middle class, trying to help the middle class, those trying to join the middle class, middle class, middle class, middle class. And now it's all about taxing the rich. Well, meanwhile, the middle class can't buy a house. How does this budget affect the middle class? Although he says it's pointed at the rich.
Well, he's wrong. He's absolutely wrong. It is pointed at anybody who earns an income in this country or pays taxes in this country. I don't like when the government does this. I don't like when they lie, Scott. They're lying about housing numbers and they're lying about deficit numbers. They know they can't meet either of these targets. So they can come in and say, we're Robin Hood and we're going to rob from the rich and give to the poor, but they're not. They're just robbing from Canadians and giving to nobody. And by the way, middle class, what is that anymore? Who's the middle class? People that make $27,000 a year or more? I don't understand what this guy and his government are talking about, but I think that their expiry date is slowly starting to tick.
It's amazing how a party that has mentioned the middle class so many times, and now the middle class can't buy a home. It's stunning to think of where we are, Eric.
It's terrible. And to this, you know, you bring up the housing market. They brought up a bunch of numbers of all the new builds they're going to make. I will bet you your house, they don't meet that target. Just like I know they're not going to meet their deficit reduction target because it's impossible with taxes where they are. So that's number one. Number two, you know, we're still at a point where about 50% of mortgages have not been renegotiated since they let the prime rate go up 1,900% in less than 2 years. So that the great amount of that blood has yet to be spilled. And I don't like to come off as a negative person because then I get people texting me and Twittering me about my negativity. But believe it or not, we have not yet felt the hardest crunch of those interest rate increases. Our economy is at a very, very bad state. And I wish the government seemed more proactive to attack these issues.
Eric Kam with us, professor, economics, Toronto Metropolitan University. Always insightful, Eric. Thanks for the time. Have a great weekend.
You too. Stay healthy, Scott.
We've been talking a lot about the budget and primarily because it's taken 3 weeks for the prime minister to announce it. He wanted to make sure everybody heard it loud and clear. We did. And as Angus Reid is reporting, generational fairness, 7 in 10 Gen Z millennials say Trudeau's government not working in their interest. A little kinder than what the National Post was. First reading, polls show youth now hate Trudeau more than ever. Voters who came of age under Trudeau government despise it at higher rates than anyone else. Fascinating considering this was the wheelhouse way back when. Sunny ways, the selfies, all of that that helped drive the prime minister to the success that he had on his first mandate. Obviously, younger people now looking elsewhere. Let's bring in John Rowe, research associate with Angus Reid in here now. John, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on, Scott.
So, boy, John, we just keep getting poll after poll after poll, whether it's yours or other people's, saying basically the same thing, but also now focusing on the younger voter, which for the longest time was the prime minister's stronghold. How bad is it with the younger voter?
Well, right now, it's I'd say it's pretty bad for them, and especially coming in the wake of this budget that, as you said, kind of was very aimed at kind of recapturing their vote, kind of bringing them back in the fold with these measures, especially on housing affordability. But right now, 18 to 34-year-olds, about 37% said they would vote for the Conservative Party if an election was held today. 36% say they would vote NDP. And 12% say they would vote Liberal. So there's quite a bit of ground for them to make up among these voters.
Where are they going? And you just gave us a great example there, NDP. Many are questioning whether the NDP or why the NDP is propping up this government. Are they soon going to have to make a decision? Is the support that is falling from the prime minister, is any of it landing with the NDP?
Yeah, a certain amount of it is, at least among kind of those generations, but it's not really kind of making a big difference nationally, I would say. We've had the NDP at about 19% or kind of 1 or 2 percentage points above that over the last couple of years, kind of since the 2021 election. So nationally, it really hasn't made a big difference. And that does kind of come down to the fact that our polls especially take a look at kind of likely turnout. So older voters are more likely to turn out to vote. So that the younger voters don't necessarily make as big of a difference in these polls.
Does the NDP have enough momentum to move towards official opposition? Can they pass the Liberals and take that position away?
Well, I think it's difficult just because I think the Liberals have a wider party apparatus. They have more fundraising. They have kind of more establishment, especially in kind of certain core areas, say Toronto or Metro Vancouver, that kind of will always give them a certain floor that I think that the NDP will kind of struggle to surpass. I think it is interesting, though, just because Jagmeet Singh has always kind of been a leader that people look upon favorably, much more so than Trudeau, especially in recent years. So there is kind of, I think, maybe if they can kind of galvanize these younger voters, get them to actually turn out to the polls, which I think is always kind of difficult. Younger voters, again, just don't turn out at the same rates as older ones. But if they can, maybe they can kind of make some momentum and kind of push the Liberals aside if they can kind of capitalize on all these kind of positive views from younger Canadians.
You talked about voter turnout. Is this going to be hard to predict for this election? I mean, lots of times when people want change, a lot of people show out. Yet on the other hand, when they know there's going to be a blowout, a lot of the people that are supporting that party just don't show up. What do you see or can you predict voter turnout at this stage?
I think it's going to be difficult to predict. I think for the Liberals, I think their concern is kind of on that latter point you were making is that, okay, well, if the polls still look like this in whenever this election comes, if it's next year, I guess is the kind of the expectation, assuming this kind of supply and confidence deal with the NDP holds up. If the polls still look like this, then it's a lot of Liberal voters, I think, who are also seem to be kind of growing fatigued with this kind of government. It will be kind of a struggle, I think, in my opinion, that for them to come out to the polls. On the other hand, there are a lot of Canadians out there who say that it's time for a change, who are kind of really tired of the way the country is being governed, and that maybe that will kind of galvanize them to get them out to the polls. And it is, I think, just overall just be difficult to predict at this time.
It certainly seems, it is obvious that priorities are changing for Canadians. I mean, the Prime Minister, it was all about social issues. It was all about saving the planet. And now all of a sudden it's the opposite, and it's all about affordability and such. And it's not often that you see or hear Canadians asking the government to tap the brakes on spending. But twice as many Canadians select the deficit government spending as a top issue. Are you surprised at that?
Well, I think I think for a while people were kind of more looking at the affordability thing and like cost of living, rising inflation. And oftentimes I think these kind of economic issues, people aren't likely to kind of pick more than one of them. I think they kind of look at this like, okay, like here's this list of issues. I'm really concerned about kind of cost of living right now and then healthcare. And now I think the deficit's kind of become to the forefront a bit more as kind of, I think these kind of cost of living and inflation kind of has subsided a little bit in some ways, though life is still kind of getting more expensive for a lot of Canadians. It was a bit surprising to see it kind of jump this much, but I think it's kind of entered the headlines. And I think this has kind of now become a new kind of attack vector, I think, for Pierre Poilievre and the Conservatives, where they're trying to look at this government and say, hey, these guys are spending too much and you should be concerned about this. And from our polling, we are seeing that Canadians are concerned about it a lot more.
Can you see the Liberals turning this around? Many thought this budget would do it. It's obviously falling flat, especially with the younger demographics. Is there anything you can think of, or even whether it's a carbon tax switch or anything that can pull them out of this tailspin?
I think they have a tough and high mountain to climb. I personally think it will be difficult for them to turn around. And there's just so much momentum against them. And especially, I think, with Justin Trudeau, if he hangs on as leader to the next election, I think there's just too much kind of, we want to change. We don't want to see these guys run the country anymore. I think there's too much of that feeling out there for them to really turn it around. Especially if you look at this and you say, okay, here are all these measures we're trying to do to help younger Canadians. And they look at it and they're like, I don't really trust that you are going to be able to get things done on this. So I think it will be difficult, though. I think maybe given a few more weeks of people kind of exploring the budget a bit more, maybe the government can kind of make their case a bit better and say, hey, these are really good measures. These will work. And if they can kind of convince people, but it is looking like a very steep mountain for them to climb right now.
We heard comments earlier on in the week that if they could only get up 5 points by June or so, that they would consider that a success. Do you see that happening?
Well, if they were, I think they were expecting a lot better from this budget. I think they kind of expected this would give them a boost. And if it, now that it hasn't, for them to kind of expect that gap to close by June, like kind of absent of other steps, I think that would be kind of surprising given how consistent things have been for them for the last few months. But it's always kind of tough to predict going forward. And obviously, I think even between now and the next election is a long time in political terms, but it does seem like a difficult task for them even now.
Lots of chatter about replacing the leader. It looks like he's still in, but again, more and more questions with every passing day and numbers like this. Many saying it won't make much of a difference if they do change the leader. That being said, assuming they're going to lose the next election anyway, let's assume that, is it better to unload the leader now or go through the election and start with a new leader post-election? Will anything help them if they make the change now?
Well, I think it really just depends on who they can kind of find to put in place. And I think that's part of the issue with the Liberal Party right now is that so many of their the theorized leadership candidates are connected to Trudeau, either whether that they were meant like cabinet ministers or what else. Like, I think it's hard for them to kind of step into that role, say they replaced Trudeau with somebody like Chrystia Freeland or any of those other candidates. Like, okay, well, you were part of the government. We kind of don't like the government, so why would we kind of vote for you, even though you are coming in with a new vision that's separated from? So I think that's the issue, is that there isn't really enough candidates out there, I think, to kind of separate them enough from Trudeau to kind of make a difference heading in an election, but it's difficult to predict.
John Rowe with us, research associate with Angus Reid. John, thanks for the time. Be well.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Scott.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
That's it for us. Thanks for listening. As always, we leave it to you, the taxpaying customer, to have the last word. This comes via text from Michelle. I literally went back to school and got a degree in nursing from MAC so I would be able to afford to buy a house. And I've been working for a few years now. I made $98,000 last year. And I still can't buy a house in Hamilton as a single-parent household with a teen. Michelle. Keep right, except to pass.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.